officially ready to get started. So I'm going to go ahead and swap out here the video so that you can take a look at our session facilitator, Joshua Williard, again, who's joining us from EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. Josh is going to provide some opening remarks and introduce us to our speakers. So Josh, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you very much, Dean. My name is Josh Williard. I am an environmental engineer with the EPA and the Superfund program. And before I begin, I want to talk to you guys for a little bit about the EPA SAME partnership that we have. So our objectives are to create open space for informational exchange between the public and private sectors on common design and construction issues encountered at hazardous waste sites. These webinars and the biannual symposiums that we have offer a forum for practitioners to talk about their experiences, lessons learned, techniques in design, and in construction issues. Also, this offers an opportunity to enhance communication networks and promote dialogue among professionals in the industry. After careful deliberations, Society of American Military Engineers, Denver Metro Post has made the decision to postpone the 2021 DCHWS West Symposium scheduled for October 25th through 27th due to government employee travel restrictions, which preclude government attendance at this event. Without the government partners, SAME has decided it can no longer hold an event that focuses on the private and public sector collaboration critical to DCHWS and SAME mission. With the desire to reschedule the in-person event as early as possible in 2022, purchase tickets will be moved to a 2022 date, and SAME is currently evaluating a 2022 date that will work for the Grand Hyatt, assuming that the government travel restrictions are lifted for that time. Once this date is set, an email will be sent out, re-announcing the event, reopening registrations and sponsorships. In the meantime, please bookmark the DCHWS webpage, www.dchws.org, where up-to-date info will be posted on the DCHWS West Symposium, as well as other events. And we look forward to the East Symposium next year, March 30th through April 1st in Philly. So far this year, we've had 7 webinars in January, March, May, July, and September. And keep a lookout for information from us with regards to upcoming webinars in the 2022 fiscal year. And also, we're in the process of developing EPA SAME construction management training, so keep an eye out for that. And as I mentioned before, make sure to bookmark dchws.org to stay up to date with upcoming events and access to the archived webinar events. And I'd like to tell you guys a little bit about our presenters today. We're very excited. First, we have Mike Perlmutter. He is a senior environmental engineer with Jacobs, formerly CH2M. Since 2003, Mike is located in Atlanta, Georgia, and is a licensed PE in Georgia, New Mexico, Wyoming. He has 20 years of experience developing remediation strategies, leading the evaluation of remedial alternatives to meet site objectives, designing the site remedy, and supporting its construction, operation, and data analysis. Mike has a BS in civil engineering from Georgia Institute of Technology and an MS civil engineering from the University of Texas at Austin. Joining him today, we also have Monica Fulkerson, a PE for Jacobs. Monica is also a senior environmental engineer at Jacobs since 2006. Monica is located in Charlotte, North Carolina, and is a licensed PE in North Carolina as well. She's on screen now, everyone can say hi. She has 17 years of experience and serves as a senior technical consultant, design manager, and a project manager, specializing in site management and remediation projects. Monica has a BS and an MS in civil and environmental engineering from Virginia Tech. And now, without further ado, I will hand things over to our instructors, Mike and Monica. Thank you guys very much, and we greatly look forward to your presentation. Take it away.
Thank you. Let me get my screen switched over here. And I believe we are ready to get started here. So thank you for that kind introduction. And with that, I am going to skip us forward to the agenda slide. We have broken our presentation into 4 main parts. First, we're going to give you some background on the facility itself that we're talking about. And then we'll move into how the Environmental Restoration Program, or ERP, came to be, what it includes, and also provide some context on the role of Jacobs at this facility. Then Mike and I are going to provide some site-specific examples of how the remediation program has been optimized with respect to duration and life cycle cost. And then we'll take a look at green and sustainable remediation as a different metric to measure optimization. So let's start with the facility background. The focus of our discussion today is a large federal facility in eastern North Carolina. The facility was commissioned in the early 1940s and remains active today. CERCLA investigations and remediation has been underway since the mid-1990s. And currently we have about 50 active environmental sites across the nearly 240 square mile facility. This includes chlorinated solvents, sites with munitions and unexploded ordnance, and sites with emerging contaminants. Our facility is located along the Atlantic Ocean within the coastal plain of southeastern North Carolina. The land across the large facility is diverse. It includes forests, water, developed land, and it's traversed by various swales, wetlands, streams, and creeks consistent with coastal Carolina. We've provided a typical geologic cross-section here, which includes sand and silty sands with discontinuous clay and cemented sand units. And together, this creates a 7 aquifer system. It's worth noting that the geology across the facility varies enough that it needs to be investigated and considered at each of our environmental sites individually. Generally speaking, historical operations, storage, and disposal practices are the cause of environmental impacts to soil and groundwater across the facility. Areas of concern potentially causing threats to human health and the environment were first identified in 1981. So that will bring me to how the Environmental Restoration Program came to be and the relationship with Jacobs. The Environmental Restoration Program began in 1986 following the enactment of SARA, and a Federal Facilities Agreement, or FFA, was created in 1991 between the federal government, the North Carolina Department of Environment, Health, and Natural Resources, which is now DEQ, North Carolina DEQ, and the United States Environmental Protection Agency. The purpose of that FFA was to ensure that environmental impacts are investigated and that proper actions are taken to protect public health, welfare, and the environment, and also to establish a procedure and schedule for developing, implementing, and monitoring appropriate response actions, and also to encourage public participation while facilitating cooperation and exchange of information among associated parties. From the Federal Facilities Agreement, an Environmental Restoration Program partnering team was established. And the mission of this team is to work together to clean up hazardous waste sites using innovative, quality, and cost-effective technologies. The team includes consensus and non-consensus members. And the consensus members are the federal government, NCDEQ, and US EPA. And these are the decision makers that drive the path forward. And they are supplemented by the non-consensus members, which includes government contractors like Jacobs, and maybe also a moderator, if appropriate. This team meets on 12-week cycles or more, if needed, to facilitate decision-making and expedite work. And we really wanted to emphasize this because this team is the catalyst that allowed so much of the optimization effort to occur efficiently. So having the facility government and the regulators stacking hands and strategize and make decisions together that led us to the results that we're really excited to share with you all today. We wanted to provide a little context for how Jacobs fits in and which parts of the sandbox we're allowed to play in. Our contract allows us to execute CERCLA steps from preliminary assessment through remedial design. Then remedial actions have to be implemented by others, typically a remedial action contractor. And then Jacobs is re-engaged with long-term monitoring and optimization. We're able to use treatability studies and pilot studies throughout the process to help with our decision making and also to help set the stage for optimization. And we're going to talk more about that in detail here in a few minutes. This is another area where that partnering team approach proves beneficial. We can work with the team to say, you know, let's try this and see if we can move the needle on a particular site. So to round out the background slides here, we wanted to focus you on the long-term monitoring program at this facility, just so you can see what our starting point was. The program currently includes 18 sites for which long-term monitoring is conducted to evaluate migration of contaminants, the effectiveness of the selected remedies, and to evaluate progress towards meeting cleanup levels at sites with remedies in place. Our program includes groundwater, surface water, pore water, and sediment, which are analyzed for site-specific constituents of concern and may include VOCs, SVOCs, PAHs, metals, pesticides, and also for natural attenuation indicator parameters where we have sites that include natural or enhanced attenuation processes. We sample these sites as frequently as quarterly, and as infrequently as once every 5 years in support of the five-year review. And this altogether rounds out to be about $1 million program every year. So with that, we are going to pause just for a moment and see if there are any initial questions before we move into the site-specific examples.
We're definitely getting a couple in now. I will ask you some, and I'll try to kind of amalgamate some of the questions together so we can answer a couple of them at a time. So we're getting a bunch of people asking about optimization. And was GSR part of the optimization work from the start? And was that added later or requested by the owner or regulators?
The GSR was something we, I would say, have added in over time. It was not necessarily requested as much as going back to that partnering idea, as it was an idea that was brought up and everybody said, yes, let's do that. Let's take a look. And we went ahead and moved forward in that. A lot of this, though, stems from just doing the next right thing. And as we are going through these optimizations of our sites, and we're going to talk about this, I think, a little bit here later, the things that came out of our GSR evaluation were just the next right thing to do.
Gotcha. And is that optimization work still going on now? And is that a site-by-site basis, or is it an all-inclusive angle that you guys are trying to approach the site with?
Oh, gosh. Can I answer both? I think certainly it's ongoing. I don't think optimization ever ends when you have a program of this size. So we're constantly looking for ways to be more efficient, to close out sites, if there's anything we can do to better manage these sites. And also, you know, across our programs, as we look back at sites again with emerging contaminants, this is going to be part of our strategy as we move forward, you know, that we're starting back over with a new set of contaminants. And these are concepts we're going to keep in mind as we move those sites forward as well.
Gotcha. One question, I don't know how much you're allowed to answer on this, but a decent number of people have been curious. if Jacobs has been the remedial contractor for the entire time or other contractors that have been present on base.
Jacobs took over this contract in the early 2000s. So there was another contractor on this facility before us. And what we're doing is coming in and reviewing some of those remedies that were put in place back in the early 90s by the other contractors and seeing if they still make sense and how can we improve on them.
Gotcha. Thank you. Ooh, we got another one. I like this one. There's not going to be any confidential information in here. A couple of people are curious more about monitoring the pore water, kind of why you guys do it, what the purpose of that is, if you guys can speak to that at all.
Right. So we don't have a regulatory driver behind the pore water. It's more just for us to understand how the groundwater is interfacing on in our surface water bodies. And it's another line of evidence for us to look at discharge to those surface water bodies. It's more, so we're using it as a multiple lines of evidence type approach, as opposed to, we don't have a cleanup level per se that we're trying to achieve.
Gotcha, thank you.
Sure.
One person asked, what does GSR stand for? And I admittedly asked Gene the same exact thing not 5 minutes ago. And that stands for Green and Sustainable Remediation. And would you guys be able to talk to us a little bit more about what that kind of entails, because I don't know if I'd heard that term before.
Yes, absolutely. So that is going to be the back part of our presentation. We'll really get into the details of what we did there. And we will do our best to make sure we're defining our acronyms here moving forward.
Gotcha. All right, anonymous attendee, we will answer your question in greater depth later about GSR. I think we might have time for one more question we can squeeze in. So we're getting some questions about land use controls and what sort of land use controls are part of the record decision.
Yes, so that's another one we're going to be able to speak in more detail about with the next set of slides, but we do have a series of land use controls that are applied here. Aquifer use control, intrusive boundaries. We have some boundaries for vapor intrusion evaluations and so forth. So we'll get into some of those details here in a minute too.
All right. Well, then I think this is a good segue to the next part of the presentation if all the questions are going to be answered later on.
Fantastic. So I am going to hand it off to Mike.
Thanks, Monica. So I'm going to dig into the remediation optimization at 8 of our sites. And the idea is to kind of provide a broad spectrum of the tools we've been using to either reduce remediation timeframes or reduce lifecycle costs, or really do both in some cases. What we've been able to do over the course of about 10 years is to really use a series of innovative technologies in the guise of pilot studies and treatability studies to help, as Monica said, move the needle on these sites. We've tended to focus our treatment on accelerating mass removal, particularly in the source areas, because there's a lot of bang for your buck in terms of reducing the mass and getting an impact down gradient. And there's also a lot of optimization of our monitoring program as well as part of this. The graph I've got here just kind of shows the range of techniques that we've used via pilot studies over the last 10 plus years. Our remedies have kind of focused on three main areas. We've used bioremediation a good bit. You can see that's probably predominant among all these sites. We've used air sparging, biosparging, and soil vapor extraction, more physical techniques in most cases. Those are the yellow bars. And then we've used enhanced pump and treat, which really gears towards groundwater recirculation and helping to distribute reagents and other components to our remedies around, rather than just conventional pump and treat. So next slide, please. So I'm just going to go through the 8 sites. You'll see a pattern emerge here. I'm going to give some background on each one, talk about the remediation systems that were put into place, touch upon the conceptual site model, and then what we've done here to optimize the sites as best as possible. Site number one was a former creosote plant. It was operated briefly in the 1950s to treat lumber during the construction of the railroad at the facility. And as you might expect, you've got PAHs, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons in soil and groundwater at the site. So the response to finding the PAHs in site media was to implement a long-term monitoring plan and land use controls way back in 1997. And then in 2000, 3,300 tons of SVOC, or semi-volatile organic compound impacted soil, was excavated. And the idea is, with the source material removed, the expectation was that natural attenuation would take care of the residual PAHs that were in the groundwater. Next slide. So what you'll see on these series of sites is we pull together a conceptual site model, kind of a visual of what's going on at each site, and it kind of helps us manage the strategy at each particular site. We update these every year as a result of our long-term monitoring program and any kind of changes in the land use controls, for example. So what you notice here is that, you know, the various layers of the aquifer, the superficial, intermediate, and deep in this particular case. We'll point out areas where we have surface water impacts, not in this case. You'll also see the land use control boundary. So in the top left part of this figure, you've got this pink line that represents the aquifer use restriction that Monica mentioned before. And at this particular site, we've got a future risk to residents of ingestion or dermal contact with groundwater. So all these elements are our future on the site. So this is a particular case where we have these residual contaminants that are just hanging around. And the idea is, you know, do we keep monitoring this into perpetuity, or can we advance the site a little bit further? So next slide, please. So again, we had stalled attenuation of PAHs at this site. So we took a multi-prong approach to try to move things along here. We used direct push technology to inject some slow release oxygen product in the superficial aquifer to try to stimulate degradation of the PAHs. We also used that same product in some socks that we placed in the deeper zone. They were too deep to use DPT to inject. And then once we had those products in the ground, we then used some nearby monitoring wells to recirculate groundwater to better distribute the oxygen throughout the zone to really improve the biodegradation at this site. One of the things you'll notice here is that the very low North Carolina goals of the site, these are 0.05 parts per billion, so very low. What we did achieve is reducing the benzoanthracene and benzobefluoranthine to below the North Carolina goals in the shallow zone, which was a good achievement. And though we did see some mass reduction in the deeper zone, we were not able to keep it from fluctuating above and below the North Carolina goals. So the outcome of this optimization exercise is we were able to kick the superficial aquifer out of the LTM program. And we were able to work with the partnering team to reduce the sampling frequency in the LTM program to every 5 years. So what the end result is that we invested about $150,000 into these various pilot studies. And we're able to realize savings of nearly $180,000 over 30 years of savings from removing the superficial aquifer from the LTM. And then another $500,000 by reducing the deep zone monitoring from annually to every 5 years. So by spending $150,000 at this particular site, we got rid of the superficial zone, and we're saving upwards of $700,000 in life cycle costs. So a true optimization at this particular location. Next slide, please. So moving to site two is a former fuel farm where we had 15,000 gallon above ground storage tanks and associated equipment. This was active for 50 years from the 40s to the 90s. There's also a vehicle maintenance garage and a weapons cleaning area. And the result of these activities is chlorinated VOCs in groundwater. In response to the contamination, a horizontal directionally drilled well was installed to implement air sparging from August of 2010 to February 2013. In this particular case, the objective was to get mass reduction at the site. The idea was if you could knock down the source area concentrations, our modeling suggested that natural attenuation would take us the rest of the way. So by February 2013, we achieved more than 70% reduction of VOCs concentrations, not only in the source area, but also within 100 feet of the sparge well. And this suggested that natural attenuation would get us there within a reasonable period of time. So M&A was also part of the remedy. Beyond the operation of the air sparge system, we did optimize the M&A network since 2011. And of course, the ubiquitous land use controls that we have at all of these sites as well. So another picture of the conceptual site model here, you'll notice the air sparge well installed in the middle of the plume that extends from the superficial into the upper aquifer. In this particular case, we do have a surface water feature that's located next to the plume. That's a potential exposure pathway. It's one of the potential risks. We've also got potential risk to future residents in terms of ingestion of VOCs in groundwater if it's used as a potable supply. And then you'll also notice that we do have some of our land use control restrictions identified on this map as well. Next slide, please. So we've got two areas that we were struggling with at this particular site. There's a portion of the plume that has TCE that was originally outside of the air sparge area that was not attenuating according to our modeling predictions. We also had some residual monochloride in the areas of the air sparge well in addition. So to address the TCE, we implemented an enhanced reductive dechlorination pilot study by injecting emulsified vegetable oil and red yeast rice extract. And I don't know if anybody's familiar with the red yeast rice, but it's a product that is intended to reduce methane production from your carbon substrates. And the idea is that more of your substrate then is used for the dechlorination process as well. We also did some bioaugmentation for this particular application. And here, rather than just using a direct injection of potable water, we did supplement with some site groundwater to help create a little bit of a recirculation cell, and again, to improve distribution of reagents. To address the VC, we repurposed or restarted the infrastructure we already had in place. So we restarted the horizontal well to continue the process of production in that part of the site. Next slide, please. So unfortunately with the ERD, and this is one of the things we've learned from our pilot studies, is it didn't work very well for the TCU concentrations. We didn't see any kind of impact on the chlorinated solvent concentrations. And what we realized is that there was really poor delivery of the substrate to the target wells. And in fact, this was a little bit of an oddball that we saw EBO nearly 250 feet away from the injection area. And there was really no obvious geologic or lithologic reason for that. So one of the things that we've learned through these pilot studies, and Monica alluded to earlier, is that you got a lot of variation in the geology and hydrogeology of these sites, that it's important to go ahead and do these tests to see if these technologies that may work in one area but do not work here. So I think that to me is part of the optimization program. Meanwhile, the air sparging system, when turned back on, went right back to where it was working before, and we have seen some early vinyl chloride concentration reductions at the site, and we're continuing to run the system it's on right now. And the idea is that we should see a reduction in remediation timeframe and perhaps a life cycle cost reduction as well. But thus far, we've spent $160,000, and probably within the next 6 months to a year, we'll realize some of these optimization savings as well. Next slide, please. So site number three is a dump area used in the 40s and 50s. Is about 5 acres. And it was used for disposal of a wide range of waste, municipal and industrial waste, with a range of trash, waste oil, solvents, hydraulic fluids, and the like. Some of it was burned and buried. Because of the wide range of waste, the site, you got a number of COCs here, lead, PAHs, and pesticides in soil, as well as VOCs in groundwater. So this is a site, because the waste remains in place and there wasn't really an obvious opportunity to do remediation here. This was a combination of M&A, long-term monitoring, and land use controls, which again is a common theme for a lot of these sites is, we think there's enough attenuation here, and we believe that, this will result in a remediation timeframe that's reasonable for these sites. Next slide. Conceptual site model here. Again, this is another site that's up adjacent to a water body and is an important potential exposure pathway. Again, you can see the location of the plume within the cross-section of the site. Here you've got a situation where you've got a little bit of a semi-confined layer here. It's a little bit different from the other sites. You've got multiple risks at the site, not only groundwater risks where you've got ingestion and dermal contact risk to future residential receptors, but you've also got contact with soil, PCBs and lead in soil. And here you've also got a potential GI risk. And again, like the other diagrams, you've got the land use control boundaries on here as well. So here, like the other sites, we had stalled attenuation of 1,1,2,2 tetrachloroethane, TCE, and vinyl chloride in the intermediate aquifer, so a little lower than the superficial. And here again, we used ERD, but this time we used DPT instead of permanent injection wells, using a similar mix of EVO, red yeast rice, and microbes. And again, showing the difference between these various sites, we did see some good reductions in the parent compounds, upwards of 80%. And Though we saw some daughter product concentrations flatline at the site, we suspect that we did have some generation and some subsequent loss as well. One of the things that we encounter at this particular facility is because we're dealing with, in some cases, some fairly low concentrations, we're really on the cusp of whether or not biodegradation is the right solution here, as in some cases, there's not enough material for the bacteria to degrade. So that's one of the things that we're trying to evaluate as part of these pilot studies is, can you push it further with biodegradation or not? Next slide, please. So as a result of the VOC loss, even though it wasn't, we didn't quite get down to the North Carolina goals, we saw enough reduction that we could reduce the LTM sampling frequency from biennially every 2 years to every 5 years. So by spending nearly $100,000 at the site, we're able to realize about $200,000 in life cycle cost savings. Even though, again, you know, $6,600 may not sound like a lot, but when you start thinking about these long remediation timeframes, it does add up over time. Next slide. So site number four is a small dump, not known when it was operation, and it was used for paint cans disposal, is supposed. And as a result, we've got some VOCs in groundwater and here some poor water as well. The idea was, you know, let's let M&A take care of the contamination and then protect potential risk with land use controls, restrict access and use of these sites. Again, this is another site where contamination right near a fairly substantial water body at the site. So you can see there's clearly a direct connection between groundwater and surface water at the site. This is one where we had fairly robust poor water sampling techniques to see if we're seeing a transition from the groundwater to through poor water to the surface water and kind of degradation as well. Most of the contamination that's left right now is in the superficial aquifer, and that superficial aquifer is separated by a clay layer down to the deeper units. And again, we've identified the location of the land use control boundaries here as well. Next slide, please. So once again, we've got stalled attenuation of TCE monochloride in the superficial aquifer, much lower than we anticipated. What we did have, though, is in the deeper zones, it was clean. So this particular case, we wanted to look at whether we could use air sparging to help accelerate the attenuation at this particular site. So again, sort of in the guise of being cost effective, we used existing monitoring wells as part of our air sparging test. We took advantage of a deep monitoring well that was below the clay and below the residual contamination and converted that into an air sparging well. Hooked up a compressor and ancillary equipment and ran a short-term, couple days test to really do proof of concept for the air sparging. We really wanted to see could we sparge below the clay and affect a larger zone of influence and start affecting change in the superficial aquifer. We ran the test and we had an almost instantaneous response. So it was clearly the right technology for this particular site. We saw concentrations drop down from 25 to 30 parts per billion down to below the North Carolina goals in a matter of days. And that held for several months. And then in time, it rebounding, suggesting there was residual contamination at the site. And we used a similar equipment to run sort of a second round. What happens if we run this longer? Will it take care of the residual mass? And we saw a good response, enough to suggest that air sparging is the right tool here, but perhaps something more robust than these pilot studies. Next slide, please. So the outcome of this particular treatise body study and optimization is that air sparging was effective below the clay lens. We saw really good air distribution. And what the conclusion was is that we would implement a more robust air sparging approach to truly achieve the North Carolina goals and cut back the remediation timeframe from the site. So thus far, we only spent $80,000 to run these quick tests. We project a full-scale air sparge system. And again, this is probably a 3 or 4 well system. It's a very small plume. Will cost $225,000. So when you factor in what we have spent and what we predict to spend, and then the life cycle costs for just keeping going in this monitoring program, it's about a wash. But if we're successful, this will then take it out of the monitoring program and really off the books. And that's really an achievement for this particular site it's worth spending the money in order to get that beam, so to speak. All right, next slide. So site number five is a vehicle maintenance facility that's been active since the 40s. It includes 10 USTs containing various petroleum hydrocarbon products. And then there's some suspicion of some site fluids, motor oil, battery acid that have reportedly been discharged to the ground surface. And then there's some chlorinated solvents as well. So this is a particular site where you've got a mixed plume. And I think we see the influence of both the petroleum hydrocarbons and the chlorinated solvents on the CSM for this particular site. Next slide, please. So like one of the previous sites, we used a horizontal air sparging well to address the source area that was installed in 2010 and run for about 2 years. Again, we set up a situation where we had shutdown milestones achieved. So it was really an exit strategy for running the active system. And we were able to achieve the TCE cleanup goals within 100 feet of the sparge well and turn it off. And again, the idea was the modeling suggested from that point on, we would have reasonable remediation timeframes to get to the end goal. In addition to the sparge barrier, we installed a downgradient bio barrier that comprised 17 vertical injection wells. And the objective of this system was to create a reducing environment at the downgrading end of the plume and protect surface water. And I'll show you in the next figure here. That was installed in 2011, and there's been a couple of injection events since then as well. And then we have long-term monitoring and M&A for the areas between it. So again, just to kind of point your eyes to the various components here, you can see the air sparging well in the middle, again, sort of representing the source area. And then there's some black dots sort of on the right side of the plume area that represent the biobarrier. And again, the intent is to destroy the VOCs before it gets to the bay. We've got similar risks that we do with other sites. You've got a ingestion and contact risk to future residents. Here you've got some VI risk as well. You can see the buildings there. And as I mentioned before, the surface water also is a potential exposure pathway. Next slide. So we've got multiple enhancements at the site. One of the things we noticed here is that we've got vinyl chloride lingering in the source area. But we did notice that the geochemistry suggests that there's reducing conditions. So there's an idea to us that, you know, if you can just get the geochemistry just right, we could continue to get vinyl chloride reduction. And we suspect that the reducing conditions of the site are probably helped by the petroleum hydrocarbons that sort of act as a carbon source in this site. So one of the tests we used was the use of biotraps to evaluate different techniques to help try to get to the vinyl chloride. I don't know if you're familiar with biotraps, but it's a substrate that you can deploy. It's in a container down a monitoring well that you're able to basically attack substrates or bacteria, and the beads that are within the biotrap can be analyzed to see if you're making any kind of progress with remediation. So in this case, we had three test cells within this biotrap unit. We had a control. We had one where we just bio-augmented with a commercial bacteria culture. And then we did one with biostimulation and bio-augmentation. And the idea is, you know, what does it take in order to affect monochloride change at these sites? And what we found is that just the bugs alone, bio-augmentation alone, without having to deal with carbon substrate injection, was sufficient to see monochloride reductions within our test well. So in response, we did a pilot study where we injected the bio-augmentation culture, chased with anaerobic water in the intermediate aquifer, and allowed the bacteria to do its work. As it turns out, though we saw the right geochemical conditions and some reduction, we did see some daughter products, including ethene, as a result, we really didn't see any material vinyl chloride concentration changes. So our suspicion is that perhaps we didn't get very good distribution with our bacteria, or we didn't wait long enough in order to see change. But again, this was a relatively cost-effective attempt to take care of the vinyl chloride and see if we could do that with a low-cost approach. In addition to the vinyl chloride tests that we implemented, we tried to optimize the biobarrier. Rather than using direct injection, we used groundwater recirculation to rejuvenate the biobarrier in this last event back in 2019. So without using any potable water, the idea was to extract water from neighboring injection wells and then re-inject the water with a substrate to create a much better barrier for the site. And then, as we have with other sites, we are planning on restarting the horizontal well to address the residual COCs. And again, because the vinyl chloride did not respond to our biological treatment, we're going to go ahead and go back to some physical stripping, but also include the testing of some warm air injection. And again, the idea is that we feel like we're on the cusp of seeing vinyl chloride degradation, that perhaps if we can shift the groundwater temperature higher, get better kinetics, and perhaps get a combination of volatilization and aerobic degradation of vinyl chloride, again, as part of this test as well. Next slide. So again, here, we're sort of in the middle of optimization. We're going to be running the air sparge well towards the end of this year, perhaps early next year. We've only spent $114,000 so far to test these techniques. And we expected to spend another $300,000 to get the AirSpar system running and do all the performance monitoring. And again, this is a case where once we see the results of that, we'll be able to compute the lifecycle cost at this point. And with that, I'm going to let Monica go ahead and give us some info on site number 6.
Yeah, we're going to give Mike a break here for just a sec. And this is one that I've been rolling up my sleeves on. So site number 6 is a large site within an industrial area at this facility. And within this industrial area, there are maintenance shops and warehouses, paint shops, printing shops, auto body shops, and all sorts of other small facilities. So there wasn't one singular release that caused environmental impacts here, but rather spills and leaks over time have resulted in the release of petroleum-related products and solvents across this whole area. So the constituents of concern at this site are PCBs and pesticides in soil and VOCs in groundwater. The ROD for this site was signed in the early 90s and included excavation of soil to industrial standards in 1995 and the operation of 2 groundwater extraction and treatment systems that began in 1994 and then was then expanded in 1996 to include 15 recovery wells that were screened in our surficial and intermediate aquifers. Long-term monitoring and land use controls were implemented at the site also in 1994, and we thought it was worth mentioning that the site does include a vapor intrusion mitigation system that was installed as a precautionary measure in 2012 after additional investigations at the site were completed. In 2015, the 5-year review concluded that the remedy is not functioning as designed, as new source areas have been discovered and contamination was present in deeper aquifers beyond the influence of that pump and treat system. And further, and not surprisingly, after nearly 30 years of operation, mass removal had become asymptotic. So as a result, we are currently in the process of preparing a feasibility study amendment for this site. And this is the conceptual site model for site number 6. Really, it's a lot to take in. The key takeaways are really just the size of this site. It extends across almost 600 acres. But the only risk from groundwater here is for future resident potable use, but clearly in an industrial area of this facility. All right, so for this site, we've been given the opportunity to optimize via an evaluation of technologies in a feasibility study amendment that could replace this pump and treat system that's been running for so long. So as part of this evaluation, we conducted a pilot study in an area of elevated VOC concentrations around 19,000 parts per billion. And this was an area that's outside of the influence of that pump and treat system. The elevated concentrations were approximately 125 feet below ground surface. So our approach was to install nested air sparging wells to drive contamination from depth without accumulating in the more shallow aquifers. So within a cluster, we had an air sparging well screened in our deep aquifer, our intermediate aquifer and our shallow aquifer to facilitate the transfer of mass from the subsurface to the atmosphere. And we had some good success with this approach. You can see this visually with our graphs to the right, which show how the concentrations change over time at each depth. So overall, concentrations went down. TCE was reduced up to 94%, CIS-12 DCE decreased up to 99%, and vinyl chloride reduced up to 98%. And this translates to about 50 pounds of mass removed across the treatment area. And we didn't see that accumulation throughout our study, although at the end we did see some rebound, but we believe this is more consistent with advection of upgradient contamination rather than back diffusion. So with this study, we were able to prove the concept of air sparging at depth while reducing concentrations in the area sufficiently to achieve cleanup levels within a reasonable time frame using MNA. So we spent just under $500,000 on this study, but what we gained from this is the ability to consider monitored natural attenuation in this area instead of active treatment. And that could translate to a life cycle cost savings of approximately $4.2 million. So now I'm going to pass the baton back to Mike to talk about site number 7.
Thanks, Monica. So a less grandiose site, we've got a 550-gallon UST, the stored waste oil. It was removed in 1993, and there's chlorinated VOCs in groundwater here as well. Next slide, please. So shifting gears, we used in situ chemical oxidation at this particular site to address the residual chlorinate solvent concentrations. This is a case where we used permanganate to treat the source area in 2006-2007 timeframe. The objective was to get more than 300,000 gallons of permanganate solution into the ground. We did manage to inject 236,000 gallons, which is about 60% of the design volume. And like some of the other sites, you know, sometimes doing remediation, we learn a lot about these sites. The injections were challenged by elevated water table and relatively low flow rates here, which factored in some of the choices we made later on as part of the optimization. With the ISCO in place, we shifted over to M&A and land use controls as well. Again, the idea was, you know, with the source gone, the idea is that natural attenuation will take us the rest of the way there. Next slide, please. So a view of the conceptual site model here. This is another site with a small water body. There's a creek located on the right side of the figure here. This is a site similar to the others that has ingestion and dermal contact with groundwater for future residents. There's some VI risk that we're mitigating as well. And of course, the groundwater to surface water pathway as well is located on here. Most of the contamination here is relatively shallow, and that factored into kind of the optimization technique I'm going to talk about here in a second. Next slide. So shifting from our typical in situ approaches to address the slower attenuation of CVOCs in groundwater, we implemented a subgrade biogeochemical reactor at the site. And essentially what this comprises is the excavation of impacted soil. Typically, this is done in a source area. So this was done in the area of the highest concentrations. The soil is then, the excavation is then backfilled with organic media and aggregate. It is topped with an infiltration piping, and then it is covered with low permeability materials to keep surface water out. The infiltration gallery is connected to extraction wells that are installed down gradient of the system. And here we use solar powered pumps to pump water out and then recirculate it through this treatment system at the site. So you get this sort of recirculation system that helps treat the water pulled out of the ground via the extraction wells. And then we get organic substrate then trickling into the groundwater to create this nice sort of biodegradation loop at the site. So using this technique, we did create conditions conducive for reductive chlorination. We saw a decrease in parent compounds and increase in daughter product concentrations, all of the markers of a healthy ERD system. So next slide. So based on the performance of that SBGR, we saw our new modeling results suggested that we would see reduced cleanup times by 50 years. So we were very excited about that. And given that the plume, that recirculation cell didn't quite cover the entire plume, we implemented a second treatability study at the site. This one was a little bit different because as you get closer to the creek, which is shown in the tree line on the right side of this photograph, groundwater gets shallower and shallower. So in this particular case, we're dealing with groundwater that's maybe a foot or two below ground surface. So rather than excavating particularly deep into the ground surface, we actually built sort of an above ground SBGR for the site. So it is keyed into the ground, but the reaction zone is actually above grade. And it's keyed into the ground surface. So this system is up and running as well. One of the things you'll notice in the photographs are the solar panels. We've got three extraction wells here. So we're able to pull from different parts of the plume, run it back to the treatment cell, and then get that recirculation loop as well. So we've spent nearly $600,000, or predicted to spend. I mean, this is an active site right now. And what we expect to realize from the operation of the system is $25,000 a year in annual savings with a reduction of the 50 years and perhaps more. And multiplied over 50 years, it's over $1 million in lifecycle cost savings if this pattern continues. All right, last slide. This is a 300-gallon waste oil UST that was removed in 1997. This one has chlorine VOCs in groundwater, as well as impacts to soil and soil vapor as well. So here we're in the feasibility stage. So there's actually no remedies in place right now. So again, this is an opportunity for us to help our client optimize even during the feasibility study and the design process as well. So one of the things you'll notice here again is you've got a creek down gradient of the plume as a potential surface water pathway. You can see the potential of soil vapor intrusion that's located in the central part of this picture. And then you've got exposure to the chlorinate solvents in groundwater as well. So with that, as part of the feasibility study, kind of like Monica talked about in site number 6, we evaluated various techniques that we could include in the feasibility study as proof of concept. Next slide. So here we did two different techniques, one of which to address the contaminants in groundwater. We used the tried and true ERD via DPT injection of EBO to deal with the shallow groundwater impacts. And then we used a unique system, solar-powered SVE system that we operated for 12 months to see if that would work for the soil impacts. It was a self-contained unit, comes with the solar panels, and really literally sets up and runs. Both of these pilot studies were very successful. We saw decreases in groundwater concentrations, sufficiently enough that active treatment wasn't really necessary and MNA could be used in its place. And then we're able to deal with the residual soil impacts with just the 12-month SVE system operation. We spent only $150,000 at the site and are realizing upwards of $5 million. You say, well, how do you save $5 million on a plume like this? But the idea is that without knocking out the sources in these areas, the feasibility study would have recommended more active techniques to address the plume. And based on our approaches, it's upwards of $5 million to address the entire plume, whereas now M&A takes care of it. And with that, I think there's one more slide here. So just to kind of sum up our optimization approaches at these eight sites, we've invested $2.3 million over these eight sites. And based on shorter remediation timeframes and reduced lifecycle costs, we're estimating that our client has saved $12 million in lifecycle cost savings. Not only in some cases save money, but they're able to get a remediation complete bean a lot sooner. We've also been able to learn a lot about these sites in terms of what technologies are effective. I think air sparging, by and large, across the board has been very effective. We've used vertical and horizontal techniques, so that's been instrumental in understanding how to push these sites further. We've learned that injection scenarios are challenged by heterogeneities at these sites, so each site is different. It must be approached with care. And then we've run into some roadblocks of biodegradation. In some cases, the COC concentrations, even though they're just lingering and it just seems like we could push them over the edge, biodegradation may not be the particular answer here because there's just not enough to sustain the bacterial community. And then the last slide is just a summary of all of the quantitative work that we've done here. So this really sums up the initial investment at the site. Again, looking across the board, the $2.3 million. This also shows sort of the range of concentrations that we were dealing with. You know, Monica mentioned the 19,000 that we were able to treat, but we're also dealing with concentrations that are sub PPB levels, which are challenging in their own right. You can see a summary of the reduced remediation timeframe and then the cost savings that we've calculated based on our changes. And again, there's some sites that we're still holding out on, but we expect to see some improvement either in reduced timeframes and or costs as well. So with that, we can open up the floor for some questions.
All right. Thank you guys very much. So I'm getting a bunch of questions in. Thank you guys very much for your participation. I think a lot of people are interested in the time frame reduction component of it and how you guys are able to calculate that with confidence.
With confidence, yes. What we're trying to do is we have used fairly simple models to predict remediation timeframes for the site. So we're trying to stay consistent with that. So as we input our initial conditions and we use our natural attenuation parameters and our natural attenuation kinetics, we're able to predict what our remediation timeframes are. With the new information that we collect over the LTM period, how things are really attenuating, we plug those new information. So we're really updating as we go. And then we use those same models with the lower source area concentrations with the new and improved attenuation rates to better predict the attenuation timeframe. So I think our confidence is improved by the fact that we are now using, you know, 5-10 years of actual attenuation data to plug into these models coupled with our losses. And whereas maybe we were starting these models with a little more hope, I think we have a lot more concrete information about how these sites are going to respond once we implement these techniques.
Gotcha. Thank you very much. I'm also getting a lot of questions in on optimization. And I think my favorite way to kind of summarize all of them is with optimization inception. Do you guys find that with the site this big and with timeframes, you know, this long and with so many individual sites that you guys find yourself optimizing different optimizations, or have you guys ever ran into that?
Optimizing different optimizations. Yeah, I think that we certainly learn as we go. I mean, if you're able to work at a project site long enough, we're able to invest what we learn into new techniques. That certainly helps. You know, I think what happens is that we've got a partnering team that is highly receptive to trying new things, and we've got a contract mechanism that allows it. So when we find ourselves monitoring and monitoring and monitoring and really not seeing a lot of progress, there's certainly an openness to trying things. And because you got this relatively large site with 50 sites, and over 10 or 15 years, you've had so many remediation tools that we've employed, you sort of have this tool set that we have available to us. So it's sort of this constant, I guess it is an optimization of our optimization. We're able to pinpoint what tools make the most sense based on sites that are just not moving along. I don't know if that answers the question, or Monica, if you have any more to add to that on how this is approached.
The only thing I would add is that we're getting smarter in the remedial design step, where when we implement our remedies, we're tying milestones to it. I will talk about this in an upcoming slide, but we put milestones towards it so that we're not running systems forever. And then what we are seeing now is at sites where we've done that and we're waiting for M&A to take over, some of those sites are needing a little bit more of a push along, and those are some of the ones we're coming back to and trying to accelerate their time to closure a little bit. So I kind of like that optimization inception idea.
Yeah, I think we've borrowed. I also work in the performance-based remediation area, and I think we've borrowed some of that exit strategy components to that world into the work at this site. And as Monica said, I think baking the exit strategy into these remedies allows optimization to sort of take hold rather than just being reactive to everything.
Gotcha. Thank you very much. I'm also getting in a lot of curiosity surrounding the conceptual site model. And I was hoping you guys could talk more about what goes into creating those, what kind of modeling goes into that, and just breaking down the process for us.
Monica, do you want to field that one?
Sure. I'm afraid I'm going to disappoint everybody with, it's really just our graphics folks. It's not, we don't, sometimes I'll say sometimes we're able to take a plume from EVS, for example, and overlay it, but generally we're just taking aerial photos and working with our graphics team to create the visual and adding in, you know, some of the fancy 3D components to it. So it's, unfortunately, it's not a fancy program or anything, though we can incorporate components from some of those fancy programs.
Yeah.
What else? I'm trying to summarize because we're getting so many questions. I really like what we've seen here. One question that we got in was about diffusion. So for site number 4, I forget when you guys was in charge of site number 4.
But nobody's in charge. Yeah. Yep.
They're asking about diffusion from clays resulting in the rebound of the TCE concentrations.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we were testing is the influence of the clay on air distribution. That was the one where we were sparging below this clay layer and trying to improve water quality above it. And we saw very good air distribution. So our assumption is that the air was getting through the clay. And I suspect that the clay is probably contributing to the sustaining plume at the site. So our thought is if we can run that sparge system longer through that clay system, we'll counteract back to fissure from that clay. But yeah, that was a good observation.
Gotcha. Also a lot of curiosity about the solar powered SVE system, which I'm also very curious about. So I think a lot of the curiosity is stemming from limitations and then power supply and kind of how you guys are addressing those concerns or challenges using solar powered equipment.
Yeah, well, yeah, I guess starting with the SVE system, I can't remember the actual characteristics, but it was sized large enough to run probably 5 or 10 air, SVE wells. I think we were pulling 5 to 10 CFM per well. And it was completely self-sustaining. So there was no supplemental power source. It was all generated from the sun. Now, that being said, you know, obviously we saw some cycling as part of it because obviously there's no solar power at night. You could incorporate batteries into that if you wanted to run it 24/7. But, you know, we sort of view that as an advantage of having sort of this on-off cycle as part of it. But, you know, it was suitably sized for the pilot study. I don't know if that system would be good for a significantly large SVE system, but it certainly was a nice technique to address some source area concentrations. You know, the solar power pumps that we used, fairly small. I think we're running those at about a 1 or 2 GPM. And again, those are self-sustained and pretty much just pump when there's the sun is out. Those pumps are connected to float switches within the SBGR. So if the SBGR isn't draining as we suspected, we'll turn the pumps off even if there's power available. But so it's all linked together. But it just sort of feeding into the sustainability aspect. You know, we thought that the solar power techniques remediation were a nice component to it as well. We can provide some more information on the SVE system. It was actually a rental unit. If anybody's interested, I just don't have it in front of me right now.
I think so. I think there's a decent amount of interest.
Okay.
So one of the other questions that we got was about overall groundwater flow for the site. I know it's pretty big, but are you guys able to kind of categorize or describe that to us a little more?
Yeah.
Monica, in terms of velocity?
Categorizing it overall, yeah.
Oh boy. No, you're asking the engineer about the hydrogeology. I would have to honestly pull up some information about it, but in general, we have our superficial aquifer that is discharging to the local surface water bodies across the facility. Generally speaking, below that aquifer, we're not seeing flow controlled by the surface water bodies. We see our aquifers just flowing under creeks and rivers. In general, it's fairly flat, I think, across the facility as a whole. Certainly it does flow, you know, towards the ocean. I don't know, Mike, help me out here.
Well, I was going to say, in terms of groundwater velocities, I mean, I think it's not uncommon to see, you know, 100 to 200 feet per year at some of these sites. So even though it is flat, it's permeable enough that you see changes. And that's one of the reasons why these surface waters are a big factor, because if you don't address these plumes, it's liable that the groundwater does get to surface water at these velocities. So, but you know, this is a complex environment. You've got cemented layers, you've got clay, you've got sand. I mean, as she mentioned before, the depositional environment is quite challenging. So, and I think that's probably, before we get in trouble with our hydrogeologists, probably all
right. We'll plead the fifth on that one.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Well, speaking of complex environments, we got a question here about sites 4 and 5 and air sparging that you guys mentioned that you used paired with the soil vapor extraction system. So is there any concerns with increasing the vapor intrusion risks in nearby buildings? And then if so, I guess, how do you kind of mitigate that?
Yeah, that is a huge factor in our planning for these systems. I think by and large, our systems are far enough away from the buildings that it's not a huge risk. Although we've got a very robust soluble vapor sampling program that goes along with it. And in some cases, we've got systems that are near enough buildings that we do have vapor intrusion mitigation systems already in place. So that sort of mitigates it as well. Frankly, our systems are, as we have a robust monitoring program. If we do see any kind of impact to soil gas away from our systems or even in the buildings, we'll shut our systems down. We proceed with caution is really the only way we can look at it. And again, we'll use SVE where it's appropriate, where it is near buildings. So I don't know, Monica, if you want to have anything to add to that, if that covers it. Okay. It's a delicate balance because, I mean, VI is clearly a risk at the site that has so many buildings, but we've found air sparging to be a good tool. So, we use a lot of monitoring and vapor traction is necessary to cover it.
I think a lot of people are asking the big ticket question. I've been saving this one for the end, speaking of optimization, and you guys gave us a great graph of the breakdown of the different proposed savings and over the lifetime. Can you guys speak to overall over the entire site, what is the expended cost versus the estimated savings as a result of the optimizations?
Beyond what we already tabulated there, we would have trouble, I think, assigning numbers to it at this point. I think we are continually trying to find ways to put more in the cost savings column. As we mentioned, we've got a number of sites that we're still working on, that we're still trying to try something new and see if it makes a difference. Kind of going back to my comment at the beginning about just trying to do the next right thing, and I think it would be hard to project a dollar tag, a price tag value on that. Mike, do you have a different opinion?
No, I agree. And in some cases, it's a little bit complicated by the fact that some of the savings are reinvested into the site. So where do you count that in the tabulation? It's hard to say. So, I know it's hard. I think it was good that we were able to even quantify these 8 sites, and that's why we wanted to present them. So in some cases, it's a little murkier. So.
Gotcha. Thank you very much. Well, I don't want to take up too much more time with the questions. So with that, I will pass it back over to Monica. Mike, is it you guys or is it Gene now? I forget.
Yep. We've got one more segment to go.
All right.
So next we're going to talk about the green and sustainable remediation. So the site-specific examples that Mike talked about really show how we can reduce the duration or the life cycle costs, but we wanted to take the time to acknowledge that optimization can also take the shape of improved green and sustainable remediation practices. At this facility, we followed the standard guide for greener cleanups. This guide acknowledges that the act of remediation itself creates environmental impacts in the form of energy requirements, air pollution, water use, waste disposal, and impacts to land and ecosystems. So the standard provides a process for evaluating and implementing best management practices during the cleanup phase of work. The best management practice process is boiled down to really just 5 steps. Opportunity assessment, where we're screening potential best management practices, and then that's followed by prioritization, where the most applicable ones sort of bubble to the top, and then we get into selection, implementation, and finally documentation. Oops. So this next slide shows the opportunity assessment and the screening steps of the process. And my intention here isn't to have you read all of these boxes and understand this. It's really just to show you what the tool looks like. It's as simple as a spreadsheet that's organized by applicability to remediation technology. The user works through this spreadsheet and identifies potential BMPs and which of the core elements will be impacted by that action. So we're going to walk through a few examples of how these were applied at each of the sites within our LTM program. So we're going back to site number 7. This is where we had that SBGR, and we talked about a lot of this just in the Q&A there a minute ago. So this is where we implemented the subgrade biogeochemical reactor to treat chlorinated solvents in a closed loop system. So several of the components of this system met the requirements of those BMPs. So for example, we used a bio-based material in soybean oil that we applied to the backfill material during construction. We reused clean backfill from the site instead of having to have Baro come on, transported on site. As we talked about, the pump for our recirculation system is solar powered. So these little things, they translate to reduced landfill waste and greenhouse gas emissions. They maximize the use of renewable energy and reduced concentrations in the source area, which then reduces the time to site closure. So that's this example sort of shows how green and sustainable remediation and optimization are really a hand-in-hand effort. Because many of the environmental sites at the facility are set in sandy soils, air sparging is a particularly effective technology to treat VOCs here. However, as we were just talking about, you know, many of us probably have experience with not having a clear endpoint when a remediation system is started. So we've made a practice to follow the best management practice of setting milestones for system shutdown. This is the exit strategy that Mike was talking about. So at this facility, every time we shut a system down, we're saving approximately 800,000 kilowatt hours per year. And that, of course, leads to reduced cost and greenhouse gas emissions. This next one applies to our whole long-term monitoring program. Our standard operating procedures previously required a minimum purge volume for low flow sampling. We were able to work with our regulators to remove that minimum purge volume based on the science behind low flow purging, and provided that water levels don't drop and water quality parameters are stable at the time of sampling. So just a simple change and applying that across our full LTM program, which includes nearly 400 wells every year, we concluded that we're saving approximately 2,000 gallons of purge water from being generated. And that's translating to about 55 gallon drums that are not being generated, and the nearly $7,000 required to manage and dispose of those drums every year. This is sort of related. This is another one that is applied to our whole LTM program, where required analysis allows. The no purge technology has been applied, and we've been able to do this at nearly 300 of our wells every year. Instead of low flow sampling, we utilize passive diffusion bags or hydrosleeves or snap samplers to collect our groundwater samples. So like the previous slide, this results in minimized waste generation, including purge water and sampling materials, but this also saves on on-site labor, which comes together to reduce time and cost as well. Since we are identifying optimization activities throughout the project lifecycle, it's worth considering SiteWise as a tool to advance the discussion. SiteWise analysis provides a quantitative evaluation of sustainability metrics, and it can be used to enhance optimization during both the remedy selection phase and the implementation phase. So during remedy selection, sustainability metrics can be compared and used to develop rankings, for example, within the short-term effectiveness criterion of a feasibility study or an ECA. During remedy implementation, site-wise can be used to identify opportunities to reduce the footprint of the remedy during design. So pulling this section together, green and sustainable remediation practices were used to further our optimization process because really this all goes together. The process of evaluating BMPs helps us to find that sweet spot where we're meeting our project objectives with the lowest reasonable impact to the environment and reducing project costs along the way. And as we do this, similar to one of the early questions asked, we become more aware of other opportunities to minimize environmental impacts and look to create that self-perpetuating virtuous cycle. So then with that, I am going to turn it over to Mike to bring us home here.
Thanks, Monica. Go ahead, next slide. Excuse me, I just wanted to pull together some key takeaways for our presentation here. Again, these are some things that we've been hitting this entire time. These long-term monitoring sites that seem endless can be proactively optimized to minimize remediation timeframes and or reduce lifecycle costs. We've been able to do that by implementing some innovative technologies, some tried and true technologies. We've focused our attention really on accelerating mass removal, particularly in the source areas, because that coupled with some, updated modeling allows us to really reduce these remediation timeframes. And of course, optimizing the monitoring program is a huge component to saving money at these sites. You know, once these sites are predictable and, have much less contamination and the risks are controlled, it's easier to argue for lesser monitoring programs. As Monica mentioned before, everything's tied together. Optimization includes consideration of sustainability metrics and BMPs to reduce environmental impacts of the cleanup action. Everything is connected. And I think really the most important thing that we learned from working at the facility is the communication, the cooperation, the consensus building with stakeholders really allows this optimization to happen and streamline the realization of these efficiencies. So without that cooperation, and frankly, without that meeting frequency, it's very difficult to be this proactive and really adjust to our observations in the field. So that's really instrumental in this whole process. Next slide.
That's me. I was waiting for it to go.
Well, that's it. I just, there's our contact information if you guys want to reach out to us another time. And again, this is another opportunity if you guys have more questions through Josh. But, that's the optimization that we've done at this space. Thank you.
Thank you guys very much. I think we have a couple more lingering questions that I will get to right now. Then we'll get to our kind of closing remarks. So first, I apologize, I didn't address this before, but another acronym, HDD. Can you guys tell us what that is and explain that a little more? I myself don't know it either.
It's okay. It stands for horizontal directionally drilled. And or shortened version is horizontal. So that's the technique we use to install a horizontal well at a particular site. I can go into more detail, but that's the acronym.
Gotcha. And then another acronym-related question. Was there any regulator reluctance regarding approval for using PDBs? And can you explain what PDBs are?
Sure. So I wouldn't say reluctance. We PDBs, passive diffusion bags, are they're bags that come, they're membranes that are filled with lab grade water that then we have the contaminants passing through osmosis that provide a representative sample of the aquifer. So it gets deployed in the system and it's allowed to equilibrate. And then when we pull those bags out and sample, it should be representative of the subsurface conditions. We We did, in advance of implementing this across the entire program, do some side-by-side, or rather, you know, we would take a PDB sample and a low-flow sample and show the results. And they were, you know, order of magnitude similar, but the driver was that at a lot of these sites, we weren't that close to cleanup levels. You know, we are trying to track trends and not necessarily the exact number that is tied to that sample. So what we're looking for are concentrations still going down? Are they going up? Is something different happening? If we were to, and as we do get closer to closing out these sites, one of our agreements is that we will go back and low flow sample to make sure that everything is tidy and cleaned up according to requirements.
Thank you. That was a great answer. We have a question about site 3, and I am also curious about this. So I guess in areas where, and I guess specifically in relation to site 3, where you guys have said that the site characteristics, remedies aren't working super well, and perhaps more site characterization is needed. How would you guys go about doing that?
Yeah, I'm just refreshing my memory on what site number 3 is. You know, we got a secret decoder ring for what the actual sites name are. So the question is really, what do we do once we encounter a problem, basically, with a remedy? Is that essentially the question? Mm-hmm. Okay. Monica, you can add to this. I mean, our client and the partner team is fairly responsive to new findings in the field. So we are able to, I mean, to me, I guess let me start over. A failure is a learning event as it is, right? So I think by learning by some of these, quote, failed treatability studies, that gives us a little more information about the site. And then we'll go back out there and we will collect some more information to understand what's happened. And that may include, you know, some additional microbial parameters, maybe some more detailed geochemistry. Maybe we're learning that the plume is larger than we thought, and that's why we're getting rebound. So we may go sink a few more wells or take some more grab samples. So, again, it's sort of the spectrum of care at these sites is everything we try to learn and process, and we'll go back out there and collect some more information, and then perhaps return with another treatability study.
So, to wrap it up a little bit better, let's go with something, you know, higher level overall, talking about optimization. Have you noticed that any policies or different stakeholders, your work has evolved with them as they've started to embrace optimization? Or what has the battle been like?
I can tackle that one for a start, yeah. Mike, if you like.
Sure.
We pointed out a couple of instances in the presentation that some of the North Carolina standards are very low. North Carolina has implemented a risk-based remediation program that allows for some flexibility following attainment of MCLs, of the EPA cleanup levels, for that time in between when you're at MCLs and the North Carolina cleanup levels. That is a relatively new program that is being rolled out in North Carolina, and we're working on how that may apply at the facility. Since it is a federal facility, we're in a spot where sort of all of these regulations come together. That is one area that we're trying to work on and see, is it reasonable to clean up orders of magnitude less than the EPA MCL, or can we apply this new risk-based remediation program?
Gotcha.
Anything to add, Mike? Other instructions?
No, I was just going to wonder, I mean, you've been more involved with the partnering process. I mean, has the receptiveness to this, you know, treatability study, adjust, adapt, been, you know, has that changed over time, or has it always been receptive to the team?
Oh, I think it's always been receptive, well received by the team.
Okay. So Josh, I don't know if that was the part of the question you were asking. Is that, I mean, that's been the benefit here. Yeah, that's been part of the process, is that it hasn't been a battle. I think the challenge at these sites, as Monica mentioned, is when you get right up to the finish line, is how do you get across that? And I think that's where some of the new risk stuff is going to be helpful.
Gotcha. So you guys have a lot of experience in the field. You guys know this anonymous site very well. Do you guys have any big takeaways or lessons learned, kind of overarching, from your experience with the site that you would like to indulge the participants with?
I don't know. We've covered a lot here. I mean, I have been, you know, again, we have the benefit of a fairly large playground here. And I think the philosophy of the site is that no idea is necessarily too bad to try at the site. So I think if there's a decent scientific basis, it is worth, you know, cost effectively trying new techniques to help further sites along. And I think that other teams that I've been involved with have been a little hesitant to invest money and take that risk that maybe it won't work, but maybe it will. And I think that's probably one of the things that I've seen about this facility, is that you win some and lose some. And I think just trying things, particularly as you learn from other sites, has been particularly effective. So it's really managing risk. You know, having a client that's willing to invest with the understanding that it may not work out has been, I think, an important part of this.
And I think the only thing I'll add to that is we can't stress enough how the team approach here has been instrumental to actually getting work done. We're not caught up in, you know, pages and pages and pages of comments every time we submit a document. We are working through these ideas together, and all with the common interest of advancing the facility forward. So I really just can't overemphasize how having all of the regulators, the facility, the government, how having everybody at the table has helped with the whole program.
I mean, the partnering process is optimized. I mean, that's not without it, right? Mm-hmm. So,
all right. Thank you guys very much. I appreciate all the nuggets of wisdom answering all our questions on the fly. I think I've answered all the questions that we have going in. So, yeah, I think we're ready to move on to kind of our closing ceremonies. And with that, I will pass it back to Jean.
All right. Thank you so very much. I have a handful of reminders that I want to share with the audience before we close things out today. But I also want to be sure to thank our organizers and our presenters for joining us and sharing their technical expertise, along with those of you who connected. We actually had a number of international attendees on today, so we're always glad to have you all connecting for our session. As Josh highlighted at the beginning of our session today, we have been recording the ongoing webinars that have been hosted through this EPA SAME partnership through CLUIN. So you'll be able to visit our CLUIN archive page, the URL shown on the bottom of this, to replay the previous webinars that have been hosted in this series. Today's session was recorded, and in about 1 week, you'll get a follow-up email with the link to play that back on demand, and you are absolutely encouraged to share that with other coworkers who will find this to be a valuable expenditure to rewatch today's session. The other thing I will remind to everybody, as Josh was highlighting, this has been going on as an ongoing partnership here with EPA and Society of American Military Engineers. They are working on some future training, so we do encourage everyone to visit the DCHWS website at www.dchws.org for more information. Josh commented earlier on the upcoming DCHW West Symposium, which was scheduled to take place later this year, that has been postponed. So I encourage you to visit their website to learn more about other events that they have on the books. I would also like to encourage those of you who can to visit us at the Cleanup Information Network at CLUIN.org, and also to sign up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct. So if you're interested in finding out about future free online technical sessions like our webinar today, I encourage you to sign up for Tech Direct. That goes out on the first of each month and will highlight publications, websites, resources, online events, and conferences related to hazardous waste site characterization and cleanup. So please be sure to sign up and stay connected to us. Now, as I highlighted at the beginning of our session today, we have information about today's session posted on the seminar homepage. I'm going to pass this link to you all in the meeting chat. And so that website is available from today forward. Those of you who are replaying the archived version, you can still access that link. There are information about our speakers, the ongoing series, as well as links to download their presentation materials can all be found there. And there's also a tab with a link to the feedback form for the session available. Now, one of the most common questions I get is if we offer CEUs or PDHs for our Kluwen webinars. And while we do not offer those types of credit hours, we can provide you with a certificate of participation if you attend the event live or replay the entire recording. To get one of those certificates, please be sure to fill out the feedback form and check the box at the bottom of the form certifying you were here for the whole live thing or you replayed the entire session. If you check that box and you submit the feedback, you'll then immediately have access to either download or print out a certificate like this. If you happen to have multiple parties join from your location in watching this, each person can actually go fill out that feedback form, even if they didn't register individually, to get their own certificate for their own records. If for any reason you don't get one of those, it's likely that you didn't check the box, you can contact me. We'll try to pull your records and regenerate the certificate for you. And again, for those of you replaying the recorded version, you can still follow the link to that homepage and fill out the form and get a certificate based off of your replay. So with that, I think we have reached the end of our session today. Again, I want to thank all of you who joined us for today's live broadcast, our presenters who shared a lot of really great technical information. And I'll just say my reflection after listening to this was the takeaway message is that optimization is good. So that is the little mental note that I have made. But again, we certainly encourage you to stay connected with us and to join us on a future seminar. So again, thanks to all of our speakers and organizers, and thanks to each and every one of you for joining us for today's live.